KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Thanks for joining us. We're going to take a look at how media shapes history. We're going to talk with the Interfaith Amigos about how ancient texts are being shaped in the modern world. We're going to talk to David Stockman about the American economy. And we'll take a look with some media folks about just what happened last week when the media tried to cover this fast-breaking story. But we start in Washington, D.C., where the media was trying to cover this fast-breaking story and many more at the same time last week. So what is this week like? What was it like to work in Washington, D.C. last week? Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill news producer for CBS News. Hello, Jill.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I am fine. How are you recovering from a fast-breaking week of news?
Well, really, honestly, I think that this week could be just as intense, only we have more of we know more of what to expect in terms of the questions that will be asked this week. Last week, it was literally one thing after another in terms of us learning at the same time as most Americans that the bombings had occurred at the Boston Marathon. Then we we all scrambled to find out what lawmakers knew, especially on the Intelligence and Homeland Security committees, to see if they'd been briefed by anyone. The information was very slow going in terms of what happened. It took really a couple days before members seemed to have any even clue of what was shaping up. Then on Tuesday, at the very first full Senate briefing on the Boston bombings, we learned that letters had been intercepted that were supposed to go to Senator Wicker of Mississippi that contained ricin. So at the same time as we're trying to figure out all this information on the Boston bombings, we find out that there's been an attempted poisoning on a senator that luckily was intercepted at the mail facilities. No one was hurt. And we found out later there also was one sent to President Obama.
By the way, on that ricin story, was that just coincidental that it occurred during the Boston bombing?
It was absolutely coincidental. The man that is accused of sending those letters is still in court today. His name is Paul Kevin Curtis. He's from Mississippi. Senator Wicker told us last week that he and some friends had hired him as an Elvis impersonator at one of his parties, and that he had spoken to him, that he was very friendly, very entertaining, very good at being an Elvis impersonator. But clearly, what we've been told is that the man has some mental illness and obsessions with organ donations and transplants, and he had regularly written to Senator Wicker. So clearly some sort of obsession if he truly is convicted of doing this, though he does maintain his innocence. Hmm.
Jill Jackson is the CBS news producer on Capitol Hill. So this will be as intense a week in terms of politics, as you mentioned. So here we already have Schumer and Grassley. We also hear from McCain that the people who helped write this bipartisan immigration legislation say that the Boston Marathon bombings should expedite the overhaul of the system. This is Lindsey Graham, I guess, and Schumer. How are they making this connection?
Well, they're saying that if more illegal immigrants who were of no harm to the United States came out into the shadows, if there was a more efficient immigration system, that it's possible that maybe some red flag would have come up. What they're really doing is they're very much on defense. Senator Chuck Grassley started the whole questioning on Friday about whether saying that it's very important for Republicans to have to understand the gaps and loopholes in the current immigration system. Then today there is a hearing, an all-day sort of marathon immigration hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's where Senator Chuck Schumer had made the case that that immigration reform should happen now, and that and there was actually a very heated exchange between him and Senator Grassley, where he said that that opponents of immigration reform are using the Boston events as an excuse to oppose the immigration bill. And Senator Grassley actually loudly yelled back at him that I never said that. But clearly opponents of the immigration bill are using this. Senator Rand Paul sent a letter to Majority Leader Harry Reid this morning saying that we should not proceed on immigration reform until they understand the specific failures of the immigration system, why it did not find that these two individuals from Russia had had ties to Islamic extremism, and why there weren't safeguards to red flag these two individuals, and to know if there's anything that could have prevented the attack or that could have alerted authorities that these two men were a danger.
Well, Senator Grassley is quoted in the paper today. Given the events of this week, it's important for us to understand the gaps and loopholes in our immigration system. While we don't yet know the immigration status of people who have terrorized the communities in Massachusetts, when we find out, it will help shed light on the weakness of our system. I mean, there's a lot of assumptions packed into that. It sounds like he is using it as an excuse to oppose the program.
Absolutely. And I think between him and Senator Paul and also Senator Jeff Sessions, they've all been raising red flags that signify that they would like to take a look at this before actually taking on any comprehensive immigration reform. Also, just now, we just got a tweet from Marco Rubio, who is one of the authors of the immigration package, saying that the Boston bombing is not an excuse for inaction on immigration reform. So really, I think we're going to have a lot of jockeying. This is a problem that immigration reform proponents really did not need, because it was already going to be a steep climb for both houses of Congress to pass a comprehensive bill that included a legalization component for those who are currently here illegally. This really, truly is going to make the path much, much more difficult.
Well, people are already tossing log jams in the path. So now we have request from the, the House Committee wants to see the administration's, any intel the administration has on those two brothers. One was a naturalized citizen already. The other one was here on a visa.
That's right. There was a letter sent over the weekend by Chairman of the House Homeland Security, Mike McCall, and former Chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Peter King. They sent a letter to Napolitano, the FBI director, asking what they knew of, basically asking for all information possessed by the U.S. government related to the Tsarnaev before April 15, 2013. We know that the FBI did interview the older Tamerlev Tsarnaev at the request of the Russian government, for they were concerned about extremist ties, but apparently the United States did not learn anything from those interviews, and at this point we do not know if there were ever any follow-ups. Both King and McCall are frustrated because they say this is that Tamerlev Tsarnaev appears to be the fifth person since 9/11 to participate in terrorist attacks, despite being investigated or at least interviewed by the FBI. They would include, the underwear bomber is part of that as well. So they're saying five of six intelligence failures have taken place since 2009, which directly implicates the president in their accusation here. They are requesting just any information that the FBI or Homeland Security Department has on these two men, specifically the older one, who we also know traveled for 6 months to Russia last year. They want to know more about what he was doing there.
Any indication of how the administration is going to respond?
Well, at this point, I imagine usually in situations like this, they truly do respond with some sort of briefing or letter back to the committees. They try to keep Congress in the loop, though not necessarily on everything. So I imagine it's possible when we get that response that we might have a clearer picture of what the FBI or Homeland Security Department knew and when they knew it, if anything, more. But it sounds like from initial reports they did not know a lot.
You said it would be an intense week. Does that also mean that we'll have some more conversation about gun control?
Well, the conversation, I think, will be simmering. I think, there is a possibility. There have been reports that the guns that the Tsarnaev brothers used against the Boston police last week were unregistered. And there's some speculation that that could maybe spark the gun control debate back up again. However, I will say that at the end of last week, with the failure of the background check amendment sponsored by Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Pat Toomey, with that failure and with Majority Leader Harry Reid pulling the gun control bill from the floor, even just a basic bill that would crack down on gun trafficking, the chances of gun control going anywhere are incredibly slim after the political capital that people spent last week. The Newtown families were here for a full week lobbying members. They had some very emotional meetings with members, and it did not seem to have much of an impact. So I would say at the moment, while we could hear little smatterings of gun control talk, I think that it's still dead and probably will be until, hopefully this doesn't happen, but it probably will only come back, the debate will only come back in real seriousness in terms of action when another event with a gun happens.
And meanwhile, Jill Jackson, we have GOP lawmakers want to see the Boston suspect questioned and tried as an enemy combatant, and the Democrats think federal courts are sufficient. Will that be that debate's going to play out in D.C. as well?
Absolutely. I mean, what we're waiting for right now, we're looking, there's not much that Congress can really do. They can't really do anything to force the administration to try him as an enemy combatant or use civil courts. What they can use is their platform to put the pressure on the administration to act in a certain way. So we're waiting for announcements of hearings on the Boston bombings, hearings related to enemy combatants. And it so far has been really going down party lines, Republicans saying that that Joe Carr should be tried as an enemy combatant so that he would have a military trial and could be held indefinitely, while Democratic senators, including the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, says, look, we can use our federal courts, we can seek the death penalty and secure a conviction that way, that is the most constitutional path. And she said on Fox News Sunday yesterday, she also pointed out that there's been success in the case of Farouk Abdulmutallab in the underwear bombing. They successfully got a conviction there using civil courts. So she's saying, go with precedent. It's the most constitutional. I imagine this will be very much at the forefront, though, of the public comments on coming from Capitol Hill this week.
All right, Jill. I appreciate you giving us an update. I appreciate it very much. Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill news producer for CBS News. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday, and of course, in light of that, there is the Guantanamo hunger strike, a story that's unfolding. We'll try to follow it with you over the course of the next few weeks. This is Weekday.
You get your voice back there. I'll take it for a minute. It's 9:18, a conversation about how media shapes history by controlling information in a minute.
KUOW and Copper Canyon Press present A Universe of Poems, a book release celebration featuring Ghanaian-born Jamaican poet Kwame Dawes. Friday, May 3rd at the Seattle Asian Art Museum. Opening for Dawes will be Youth Speak Seattle. Learn more at the events page at KUOW.org.
48 degrees in Seattle under a clear blue sky. Forecast calls for lots of sun today and a high of 60. The Bible, the Torah, and the Quran are ancient religious texts written for an ancient audience. So how are those ancient teachings being adapted for a modern audience? The three interfaith amigos share their insights in about 20 minutes.
But first, thousands of years ago, the development of writing gave power to writers, to leaders, to those people in the know. Today, the computer gives power to coders. How is that power used, disseminated? William Bernstein chronicles the impacts technology has on human communication from its origins to the 21st century in his book, Masters of the Word, How Media Shaped History from the Alphabet to the Internet. Thanks for coming in, sir.
Glad to be here.
Dr. William Bernstein is an author, financial advisor, and retired neurologist. He co-founded the finance company Efficient Frontier Advisors, providing personal finance services. He has written several books on topics of economics and investing, including The Intelligent Asset Allocator. He joins us from North Bend, huh?
No, actually Portland.
Portland. You've moved around.
Yeah.
Yeah, Portland. Yeah. I thought, did you live here for a while?
No.
Never.
All never, right. No.
That was bad data. So you know how you get bad data? Internet.
That's right.
Always verify. I've been reading that people think the media's role in the future will just be to verify. Verify, verify, verify.
That and to outsource your temporal lobes, yeah.
Yeah. Is that how you got into this as a neurologist?
No. It's a very long, shaggy dog story that leads through personal finance. Can't do personal finance unless you know some history, and I found that I enjoyed writing history.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you just say neurology's fun, being a doctor's fun, but history's more fun?
I segued from one to the other. I suppose you could say that I'm easily bored. So, you know, neurology is fascinating, but after 20 years, I suppose I'd exhausted its intellectual challenges and decided to move on.
Really? Brain surgery wasn't enough for you. Here's what you write on page 12 here, and let's just start with this. When ordinary people eventually gain access to and control of leading-edge communication technologies that can more effectively oppose the power of the state. In the democratic Greek city-states, the alphabet proved mightier than the sword. In the medieval era, printing press was mightier than the Catholic Church. And in the modern world, the cell phone camera is mightier than the surveillance camera. Which would be good news for those people who are afraid of surveillance cameras right now. They look at surveillance cameras popping up and they say, oh, we're heading down the road to fascism.
Yeah, I mean, certainly George Orwell believed that that's really what the subtext of what 1984 was all about, that in an era when the state held all of the technological cards, the individual and his liberty, his or her liberty, didn't have a chance. But technologies diffuse out into the general population and the playing field gets leveled.
You argue that it's the power that when ordinary people get the power, leaders lose their power.
That's more or less true. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of other factors involved. I don't want to, you know, give the impression that I'm, you know, giving a monocausal theory of history. Yeah, that's certainly one very important factor.
Not a monocausal theory of history, but you are saying that as we are both educated and technologically educated, we, the people, can respond.
Oh, I think so. I don't think there's any question that the rise of personal technologies and of social media have tilted the playing field towards ordinary people and away from the state.
Well, we'll come back to that because you do write about where the state can still manipulate those social media even as it's disseminated. But you do feel that how many control the machine does tell us what kind of evolution of democracy could be occurring around the world?
Yeah, and when you go back into history, back as far as, 5,000 years ago, you see the same dynamic in play. You can start in the Mesopotamian city-states and the Egyptian Empire, and you can go all the way through ancient Greece and Rome and then into the medieval and modern periods, and you see the same cycle occurring over and over again.
You quote Claude Levi Strauss, the philosopher, the primary function of the written communication is to facilitate slavery. Why did he believe that? Why was written communication about slavery at the time?
Well, I quote him in the section of the book where I'm talking about ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt. And that's more or less true because these were societies in which a very small number of people were literate. The reason why that was because the writing systems were so very difficult to master. They took 10 years. Well, who had 10 years back then? And maybe, a fraction of a percent of the people could read and write. And they were the people who got to run everything, the scribes.
Deliberately difficult for that reason?
I don't think so. I mean, the only hint that that they might have made it deliberately difficult was the Egyptians had about 30 letters, phonemes in their system, things that stood for single consonants, and eventually the Semites did extract that into a simple working alphabet. And so, why didn't the Egyptian scribes do that? Well, you could say because they didn't want to give away their rice bowl, which was mastering a much more complex system.
Did the leaders of the Egyptian and the Mesopotamian cultures have that same knowledge, or was it within a scribe class that that knowledge and maybe that power resided?
Well, the question is did the leaders, did the kings and the city-state leaders have, you know, how literate were they? I think the answer was probably that they weren't, but just underneath them were the people who really ran things. If you were a scribe, you were the equivalent of a rocket scientist and an investment banker and a GS-15 all rolled up into one.
Well, in a sense, are you saying that that's akin to how people look at this? They talk about the permanent ruling classes in UK, and they say that same thing about the U.S. in some ways, that the people who are in those middle tiers, that are the people that are working every day, no matter who's in power, are the ones that actually set the rules and control the state.
Well, social, you know, throughout history, social classes have never been perfectly mobile, but I think that social class structure today, whatever its immobilities are, I think the mobilities are a lot greater than they were, 5,000 or even 3,000 years ago.
So the social classes of the scribe era, those folks hung on to their power because that was the only place they would be finding that power. They weren't investment bankers. They didn't have the same kind of opportunities to do investment banking outside the state.
No, they really didn't. And the point was, it took this was a writing system which held the key to power that took 10 years to learn. Well, who back then had 10 years to learn a writing system? It was only the children of the elites.
Right. So why did the Semite miners, what was the first sort of motivation for the Semite miners to try to learn to read?
Well, no one really knows. The best explanation I've seen is that we're talking about a group of miners, probably at a mine, a turquoise mine, in a place called Sarabit el-Qadim in the western Sinai. And these were probably Syrians. They could have been Canaanites. We're talking around 1500 BC. They were working under the Egyptians. And the theory, I suppose, is that their foreman wanted to honor, the Egyptians wanted to honor the Semitic foreman who were building these shafts, who were directing them. And so they did it through written inscriptions, and that the Egyptians taught them this very simple system, either that or the Semites might have figured it out for themselves. And the point is, this was an alphabet that had 30 or so phonemes, letters, which was much simpler to learn, and it evolved into the later Phoenician, Aramaic, and Hebrew alphabets.
And then what did the Greeks do? What was their contribution?
Well, this is a fascinating story. Between about 1100 or 1200 BC until 750 BC, the Greeks were illiterate. This is the so-called Dark Ages. And, it was the age in which the Homeric epics came about, which were through an oral tradition. They weren't written down until about 750. And the Phoenicians were great traders, so they traveled to Greece. They brought their alphabet, and the Greeks looked at the Phoenician system, and they said, you have a lot of symbols we don't need. You're Semites. You have all these sounds that come from deep in your throat, and we don't need any of those. We don't use those. So we're going to take those symbols and we're going to make them into the phonemes we really need, which are vowels. And all of a sudden, you have a system that can be mastered by a clever 5-year-old. And within 300 years of that, 400 years of that, you have perhaps even a majority of male Athenian citizens becoming literate.
And it didn't take 10 years, of course, as you're saying. So what was the outcome of that in terms of democracy, the shaping of history, which is the theme of this book?
Well, this is of course highly speculative, but I think it's obvious when you read the history. Why does democracy develop in Greece and not in Babylonia and not in Egypt? It's because you have a system of writing, an access to power, an entree into power that is much easier to learn.
William Bernstein is author of Masters of the Word, How Media Shaped History from the Alphabet to the Internet. Well, if you don't mind, because I am under the rigors of the clock, another invention that has shaped history, I'm going to jump ahead. Because I was fascinated by your chapter on broadcasting and radio in particular. What is radio's what are the influences that come to radio that make it a popular and powerful tool for those who want to manipulate?
Well, if you think about it, yes, everybody can have a radio, and it's the same thing with television, which I don't really talk about, but for which the same basic concepts apply. But only a very few people can own and run a broadcasting station. In fact, in Europe, it was really only the governments who ran the first radio stations, and in the United States, it was powerful corporations. So you have a very few people controlling a very powerful and very hypnotic medium. This is a medium which is so salient, it's so hypnotic, that one person basically was able to convince millions of people in the United States in 1938 that they were being invaded by Martians.
Right, Orson Welles in his War of the Worlds. You talk about that it's that voice in your head, in your ear, that seems very personal and that has power.
Yes. It was Archibald MacLeish who said, the ear accepts, and believes.
What is the shaping that radio has brought to history?
Well, again, this is, rather speculative on my part.
That's why you got to write the book. That's why your name is on the cover of this book.
That's right. But it seems obvious to me that if you, as a political science, graph the percentage of regimes in the world over time that are despotic, you see there's a very sharp uptick around 1920, which was, around the year of the first commercial broadcast. Now, obviously, there are a few other minor factors that come in there, like World War I and the Great Depression. But still, I don't think that was an accident.
Yeah, you have a chart in here. Causative and correlative, right? I mean, is it enough for you to think, enough for you to speculate? The causative connections.
Yeah, it's enough to speculate, but certainly not to prove. I think it's food for thought.
You talk about Goebbels and his understanding of what he could do with radio.
Yeah, Goebbels was an absolute master. You have to understand that the time that the Nazis took power in 1932, very few people had radios. And so Goebbels immediately ramped up production of them. You've heard of the Volkswagen, the people's car, but the Volksempfänger was the people's receiver, and that was the real genius of the Nazi regime. This was a very inexpensive radio set, and it was specifically designed to receive only local stations and not foreign broadcasts. It had no shortwave band. It had very weak long and medium wave reception. And it came with a little red placard that said, if you listen to foreign radio broadcasts, you will be arrested.
And they could monitor that because people could listen in, go from house to house. You talked about the Stasi in East Germany, but in a sense, the antecedents of that were how the Nazis operated.
Yeah. Goebbels appointed tens of thousands of radio wardens whose job it was to make sure that whenever he or the Führer were speaking, that people stopped what they were doing and listened. They would listen outside walls to make sure you weren't listening to foreign radio broadcasts. They would even burst in through your front door when the radio was off and look to see what station the dial was tuned to. And if you were tuned to a foreign radio station, you went to jail.
So the interesting thing was that what did the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty learn from that when they did their own efforts to subvert the Eastern Bloc?
That's a very good question. They were, of course, working from the outside in and not the inside out. And I really don't. Certainly what the Soviet people called the voices, the Voice of America, BBC, RFE, and Radio Liberty, they were merely an alternative to a state media, which was truly awful. The Soviet news broadcasting was awful beyond belief. But also the Soviets made a critical error that the Nazis certainly would have never made, which was they produced 50 million radio sets that had superb sensitive shortwave receivers.
Yeah. Oops.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what you get when you centrally plan an economy.
Well, the chapter on radio is fascinating in and of itself, and I love the machinations of trying to block and jam the signals from the West and how that worked out. But let me jump ahead real quick just to the end. You mean you do conclude that you think because so many of us have these powerful tools in our pocket now, we can be our own radio broadcaster, our own TV broadcaster, our own newspaper. Why does that tell you that we are moving into a more democratic era rather than an era, as we saw with Boston, of chaos, misinformation, and crowd sourcing, but also crowd directing, crowd danger, the dangers of crowd?
Well, first of all, let's deal with the word dangerous. I don't think we're living in a more dangerous society. In fact, you know, if you look at anybody's data, World Health Organization, you look at statistics on violent crime, it's all decreasing. We live every year in a more and more safe society. It's just that, you know, the media makes things more salient when they do. Occur. I think we are moving into a more democratic era, but that's only in the world's developed nations. Now, this is where I want to get away from, you know, this monocausal way of looking at history, which is it's just not about communications technology. In fact, we know an awful lot about how nations democratically transform, and those factors in many parts of the world certainly do not argue for democratic transformation.
Yeah. And of course, we see the Chinese, the Iranians, the Americans, all trying to control those seemingly democratic systems. I guess we'll see that unfold next.
Exactly. But again, you know, I want to direct attention. You know, I think there's too much attention to the internet and social media as a democratizing force. I think there are other factors in the modern world that are actually more important than that. And I talk about those right at the end of the book.
Yeah, yes, you do. Masters of the Word, How the Media Shaped History from the Alphabet to the Internet. William Bernstein will be talking about this again tonight at Town Hall at 7:30. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
50 degrees in Seattle, expecting to hit 60 this afternoon with lots of sun.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral programs in six different colleges. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
The Bible, the Torah, the Quran, speaking of texts and how they move into the modern world, how do these ancient texts get translated for the modern audience? Katie Sewell, you were asking the Interfaith Amigos those questions.
Yeah, the Interfaith Amigos are Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falcon, and Pastor Don McKenzie. To start out the discussion, I asked them to lay out how the Torah, the New Testament, and the Quran were written. And since the Torah is the oldest, we started with Rabbi Ted Falcon.
So one of the distinctivenesses of the Hebrew Bible, what in Christianity gets called the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible is a collection of books written over a lengthy period of time, well over 1,000 years. The early stories in the Torah, the Hebrew Bible is divided into three sections. So the Hebrew Bible is called the Tanakh. The T is for Torah, and there are five books in the Torah. The N is for Nevi'im. Those are the prophetic books, and there are eight of those, although one of them contains 12. And then the Ketuvim, the Ch of Tanakh, contains 11 books. The Torah, is the story of creation, the story of the patriarchs, the story of the development of what became the Jewish people, clearly is an oral tradition. And we don't know exactly when that oral tradition grew up. We have an idea that it was probably written down around the 6th century BCE, you know, probably around the time of the Babylonian exile when the first temple was destroyed in 586, because the first record we have of the Torah being read was when we returned to the land under Cyrus of Persia, when the Persian Empire defeated the Babylonian Empire in the area that is now Iraq. The major books of the prophets, in the 12, were dealing with mostly 8th century BCE. The major prophets who have major books, Ezekiel, Isaiah, most of Isaiah, and Jeremiah are 6th century. These are around the time of the of that Babylonian exile, and these are voices that kept the community together. And then in the writings, you've got some earlier, some later, the Psalms, the Proverbs, Song of Songs. So the conglomeration, which is called the Tanakh or the Hebrew Bible, came together. The canonization was in the year 90 of this era. So it followed the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 by the Romans. And the books that would be included in the official canon were decided then. So you've got a powerfully long range of writings. And they are different from one another, both linguistically and in terms of theological sophistication and in terms of spirituality.
Don, the Bible came together later.
The
Christian Bible, I
what's called the New Testament, which is not a phrase I like. I like the Second Testament better because it doesn't lay any negative value on the First Testament or what Christians traditionally call the Old Testament. There are four Gospels in the New Testament, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There are a number of letters, and then the Book of Revelation. The first, as far as scholars know, I think the first thing that was written was probably one of Paul's letters around 60-something CE, about 30-some years after the death of Jesus. Of the Gospels, the first to be written down was the Gospel of Mark, around 70 CE. Matthew and Luke are variations on those. Luke written to a non-Jewish audience for the most part, and Matthew written for more of a Jewish audience. And then the Gospel of John probably as late as 100 CE. And those, all the letters and the four Gospels, along with the Old Testament, were put together around the 4th century CE into what's now called the Bible. Yeah.
Do you have a, this may be an unanswerable question, but do we have a sense of why nothing was written down for so long following the death of Jesus?
You know, I think things evolve. You know, I mean, I think immediately after the death of Jesus, the small community that was close to him were quite disappointed and even disillusioned about what had happened because they, I think, had thought he could overcome anything. And so as stories began to be told about this, I think it took a while for people to begin to realize how important it was to preserve the substance of his teachings and the thinking about his teachings and so forth. So, yeah, I think that's probably the answer. I mean, the other thing, by the way, Jesus clearly read and spoke Hebrew. He taught, as far as we know, in Aramaic, both Semitic languages. He may have known Greek because he grew up in Nazareth, a kind of a suburb of a great Roman metropolis called Sepphoris or Sippori, where Greek was the language. But the stories that we have in what we call the New Testament were written down in Greek, which is a very different sensibility from the Semitic sensibility. And that's one of the problems of translation that we've talked about on other occasions.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jamal, the Quran?
For Muslims, the Quran is the holy book, and the word Quran literally means recitations. And it is a 7th century, this is after birth of Christ, a holy book. The first revelations of the Quran happened in 610 A.D., when Prophet Muhammad was meditating in the cave, and he had this extraordinary, momentous encounter with Angel Gabriel. And that was the first words of the Quran that was descended from God, the Muslim tradition says, to Angel Gabriel, to Prophet Muhammad. And this transmission, this mysterious transmission, continued for 23 years. And the collection of only one book is called the Quran, which was completed fairly soon after the Prophet Muhammad's death. And in less than 100 years, the same Quran was spread to all the four corners of the world. So it's one book. a series of recitations, a series of revelations that Prophet Muhammad recited. And when he received the revelations, he always said that it was a very painful experience. He would hear the sound of the chimes of bells, buzzing of bees, and he would sweat and feel this very intense pain, and something would be squeezed out of him. And out of his lips poured out words of exquisite beauty, which the people around him, they recorded. And the collection of that is called the Quran. Now, I must tell you that for Muslims, the main source of wisdom, of course, is the Quran. But there are three other sources. One is called Hadith. The next one, number two. Hadith means collected sayings of the Prophet. Unfortunately, a large number of fraudulent, fabricated Hadith has also crept in. And also classed in the second one with Hadith is Sunnah, which means observing the conduct of the Prophet. That's the second source, Hadith and Sunnah. Third one, because Islam does not have any ordained priesthood, this is very hard to explain to non-Muslims, no religious hierarchy. We don't have the equivalent of a Vatican. Anybody can be a priest. Because of that, there is a lot of emphasis on the insights for wisdom from sages, elders, community leaders, scholars. And the fourth one is called ijtihad, which means individual understanding, which follows from a beautiful phrase Prophet Muhammad once said. He said, even if the religious judge advises you about earthly affairs, first consult your heart. He would always repeat, consult your heart, consult your heart. The fourth one, this individual understanding, this is very much in decline in the Islamic countries, unfortunately, these days.
And now, since the Quran is supposed to be a direct revelation, how does that change how it's interpreted over time?
Well, the book is one, of course. The words have been the same for a long time, for 1,400 years. But the interpretation can vary very much because, as we have been discussing earlier, among ourselves, that this is really a function of human consciousness. You know, when God sent down these revelations, he did not send down footnotes. And that has been a problem. So it's the human beings who provide the footnotes. And that is a function of human consciousness. It's a function, reflection of, unfortunately, in Islam, the biggest problem we have is patriarchy. Patriarchy has become an institution. It's mostly men who have been interpreting that. I will just quote the example of a great sage, Rumi, who you have heard many times. He says, you know, how we interpret a revelation depends on two things. One is the level of one's consciousness, and the second one is one's intention. And he gives this wonderful utterance, which I love to repeat, a bee and a wasp, they drink from the same flower. One produces nectar, other one produces a sting. We should go for nectar.
Speaking with the Interfaith Amigos, Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falcon, and Pastor Don McKenzie about the ancient texts that their religions are based on and how they fit into a modern context. So let's talk about how it fits into a modern context a little bit. A lot of people forego religion, partly because it can be difficult to see how these ancient stories and teachings fit into the world that we actually live in. What are your thoughts on that? Ted, why don't you?
I think what's happened in Judaism, both Judaism and Christianity are based on what Jews call the Hebrew Bible and what Christians call the Old Testament. But since that document, just as there's been major writings within Christian tradition, there have been major writings within Jewish tradition. Part of them interpretations of the scripture, part of them unfolding with needs and realities that simply weren't in existence in biblical times. The cultural milieu changes, and requirements of spirituality, of serving God, change. You know, the Torah talks about a sacrificial system, which was fine and made sense thousands of years ago. But it was losing its meaning in the final centuries of the last era. And by the first century, was not really practiced. I mean, the only thing that was being offered in the time of Jesus were birds. People, We weren't an agrarian society. We were living in cities. You know, it was a whole different context, a whole different culture. So following the Torah comes, or following the entire Bible, comes Midrash, which is expositional material, which sometimes uses biblical characters and tells stories about them that weren't in the Bible. When I grew up, some of the stories I heard, I thought were in the Bible. And then when I went to rabbinical school and I'm reading the original text, those stories weren't there. The characters grow, the stories grow, the metaphors become more complete and more relevant. So we have a vast literature, much larger than the Hebrew Bible, called the Talmud, which is written down finally around the year 500. Then you have commentaries from various countries. So that the rabbinic Bible, which is a Bible with the text in the middle and all around it, are commentaries, starting in the 11th century with a commentator called Rashi from France, and going Sforno a couple centuries later from Italy, and several other major ones who are interpreting. And, you know, the interpretations expand the meaning and the sense of the text. Jewish fundamentalism is not a textual thing, you know, like this is the word of God. Jewish fundamentalism has to do with keeping the commandments in more orthodox and traditional ways. I was just reading one of the newest translations of the Hebrew Bible is the Newly Revised Standard Version. And I was just looking at one, and there are all kinds of footnotes that say, this may mean this, and it may mean this. Like, we don't even know how to translate some of the words in the Hebrew Bible because the Bible didn't come with a dictionary. And the only way we know what they mean is through context, through places that that word or the verbal root is used other places, or through cognate languages. How was it in Akkadian and Ugaritic and Arabic and Aramaic? So to think that these words are somehow God said exactly this, I think leads us into great difficulties.
Don, how do you make relevance with these ancient texts in our modern day?
Well, of course, that's one of the tasks of preaching a sermon, is to take a text and try and see what it might mean for us. And as we have talked together and as we've gone around speaking, we try to emphasize the fact that stories in all of our traditions are, we feel, meant to be conveyances for truth, for a perceived truth. For example, the stories of the birth of Jesus involve the town of Bethlehem, a star, the magi coming from afar, the shepherds, Joseph and Mary coming and staying in a manger, and so forth. Historians and scholars are reasonably certain that Jesus was born in Nazareth because that's where he grew up and so forth. That doesn't mean that that whole Christmas scene is false. It's even more true than I had thought before because of the truths that it conveys. And I'm going to quote Marcus Borg, one of our colleagues. The idea that of light coming into darkness, the return home from exile, that is, the return from a place of what some call a distant country to a place of feeling comfortable where we belong, the tension between God and Caesar, or humanity and the divine, and the very important Christian thought that God comes into the world. That's not exclusively Christian. That's something that we all share, but that's part of the way Christian people understand the figure of Jesus. And so a lot of people, when they hear what I just said, become anxious and possibly angry. I find the beauty of the Christmas story to increase year after year. The image conveyed by the Christmas carol, Little Town of Bethlehem or Silent Night, becomes even more important, not because it might be literal, but because of those truths that it helps me to understand. And I think that as our spiritual awareness and identity evolves, that becomes even more important.
for the final word, we turn to Imam Jamal Rahman.
Yes. You know, the Quran has 114 chapters, well over 6,000 verses. And the three of us always go and say, in each of our holy books, we have verses, revelations that really reflect the most exquisite beauty. But we also have what we call particular verses that really need to be interpreted from a historical and from a textual context. And the problem becomes when we take those particular verses that sometimes are awkward, they're difficult, because they might not be in conformity with the core teachings of those universal verses. When we make those particular verses universal, that's when problems occur. I'll give you an example. In chapter 5, we say Surah, chapter 5, 51, if I remember, there's a verse that says, "Do not take the Jews and Muslims as your friends and protectors, because they are friends and protectors of each other." So for some people who want to misinterpret or use that for their own truth of convenience, they will say, ah, you cannot trust Jews and Christians. You just go a few verses lower, same chapter, 569, it says, it doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Christian or a Sabian. What takes you to heaven is just having faith in something higher than ego, having faith in God, being accountable for your deeds. But mostly, what takes you to heaven, the password, is righteous deeds. Meaning, and from other verses in the Quran, the Quran says, it doesn't matter what your gender is, doesn't matter what your religion is, what takes you to heaven is righteous deeds. So the first one I quoted earlier, don't take Jews and Christians as your friends, is a particular verse that refers to the 7th century environment when the Muslims were a small embryonic community being attacked by a larger tribe called the Quraysh, and the Muslims had treaties with the Jews and Christians, and according to Muslims, the Jews and Christians, sometimes they reneged on the treaty. So given that environment, the verse says, don't trust them during battle. They could renege on their treaty. But it is not a universal condemnation. And the other one is a universal one. What takes you to heaven is righteous deeds. It doesn't matter what your religion is.
I suppose that's part of the danger with all of these texts is people not understanding the context in which they were originally constructed, the culture, the people that they were written for.
It's true. Also, people who cling to a translation as the literal word of a being called God. I'm among those who no longer believes that God talks. I don't have a God who has a mouth like that. You know, it's not a big guy. I believe that people hear, and I believe that we hear according to the level of our awareness, according to what we're available for. So if we're stuck in our ego consciousness, what we were going to wind up hearing theologically is an ego, is a projection of that, an ego God who watches us all the time, who judges us, who rewards and punishes. That's what the ego does. If we're living at a more heartful space, well, then we're able to connect with a God who's a God of love and, you know, not a punishing God at all. And when we elevate ourselves through spiritual practices, through study, through conversation, you know, however we do that in an even more expanded state, then we are able to understand the oneness, the interconnectedness of all being in a whole other way, so that that creates the ethical demand rather than some voice saying, this is what you should do and this is what you should not do. I think when we see it as verbal revelation, we're in trouble, not only within our own traditions, but we're in trouble with each other. Because then you got a God who wrote three books, you know, and that's where a lot of conflict goes. Do you go with the newer book? You know, did God change his mind? And that's a space that's very difficult. I don't think you can get out of it.
Rabbi Ted Falcon is teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. Pastor Don McKenzie is former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. And Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Together, they're the Interfaith Amigos. Thanks again for coming in, gentlemen.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks.
This is Weekday.
For our sound of the day, Weekday listener Anita writes, "This is a recording of what I hear as I sit at my desk working in my home office. It's my cat, Rico, snoring as he sleeps on the end of my desk." "Yes," she says, "this is a daily occurrence. It is the sound of her day." What's the sound of your day? Send us a recording. Put sound of the day in the subject line and email us weekday@kuow.org. David Stockman and what's happening in Olympia among the things coming up. Stay with us.
9:59. A helicopter carrying civilians had to make an emergency landing yesterday in East Afghanistan. All passengers were taken prisoner by the Taliban. An update in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Immigration Group at Ryan, Swanson, and Cleveland, lawyers in Seattle since 1897. Online.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.